Hello and welcome into this episode of the Irish NFL Show with me, Colm Cronin, and I am delighted to be joined today from the Philadelphia Inquirer. It's Devin Jackson. Devin, how are you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to talking with you. And you know, as always, I'm always happy to talk football and talk anything related to the NFL draft. So let's get into it. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have extensive kind of history covering the draft. And in recently, obviously, you've been at the Combine. You were at the Senior Bowl. You've been putting the work in. You come highly recommended. I had been asking JP Acosta about who to kind of have on the show, and he passed along your name. So it's great to chat to you. And I suppose chatting to you on the day when your latest mock has come out. Look, mocks are a bit of fun about where it might go. Nobody knows anything, but I'm interested in digging in a little bit because I suppose, you know, look, I think in 99 out of 100 universes, Caleb Williams is going number one, but the big questions are at number two, and that's where you have Jaden Daniels as your QB2. Do you have him ranked there, or do you think it's the Commanders are more likely to take him there, Devin?
Yeah, well, I guess kind of what the feeling I'm getting is that the Commanders like really like Jaden Daniels' skill set and how it would translate in the Commanders' office under Cliff Kingsbury. So, you know, I did this in my second mock and then doing the third mock as well. It just feels like, you know, they could still go Drake May, but it just feels like they're trending more towards taking Jaden Daniels, what he brings as a runner, his ability to attack vertically downfield and in the boundaries of the field throwing as well. I just think overall it feels like it's starting to trend that way. Although, you know, I think they're still interested in Drake May, and I wouldn't be surprised on draft night if they ended up taking May. But right now, at least the conversation and the steam seems more leaning towards Daniels, but I have Drake May as my QB2 personally. So it was a little mixing between like what I would do versus like how I feel teams would do or what they would do in certain scenarios. So for me, it's kind of like balancing the in between, both taking some of what I've like heard at the combine and just some of the pre-draft events, kind of combining all those different elements to try and come out with kind of the best thought process. And obviously the free agency just happened too. So it's almost like a puzzle. You're putting pieces together. You see what teams are, you know, doing a free agency, you know, how long they sign guys to certain deals. And then like their depth chart, you know, how they feel about certain players. So really it, to me, just based on the way that Washington is kind of building things, they have Marcus Mariota as kind of the backup, AKA bridge starter, possibly depending on who they take at two. It just feels like with Mariota's skill set, and usually, you know, teams don't always do this, but teams, I know sometimes like the pair what players do really well and kind of their strengths and what they bring to the table. And it feels like Mariota and Daniels mix fits a little bit better than May and Mariota.
Yeah, I know that makes sense in terms of what you've outlined there. In your mock, at pick three, you have the Vikings going up to trade to get that from the Patriots. I suppose I have a couple of questions around this. Do you think if the Commanders went with Drake May instead of Jaden Daniels, do you think that would influence the Patriots' thinking? And I suppose just in general, what made you think the Patriots might be open to moving back in the draft? Is it the hole that the Vikings are willing to get up and the holes on the roster? Do you think that you get the sense the Patriots maybe aren't as sold on these QBs as some of the other teams, or what was it about it that for you made this make sense?
Yeah, so it's all about scenarios, and I was just kind of thinking through the scenarios. Obviously the Chargers at five are a popular trade back destination, and it makes a lot of sense. But when you think about the way the Patriots are currently constructed, they just lost Trent Brown, their starting left tackle, and they have a bunch of other holes on the roster. You know, isn't just they're a quarterback away. Obviously, they traded Mac Jones away to the Jacksonville Jaguars. So I think it's kind of a multi-step approach in that All right, the Patriots are not going to be ready to compete next year, even if they get May or Daniels, right? And obviously they have some pieces at receiver, but their offensive line, you know, needs to be retooled a bit, you know. And I think when you look at the left tackle position specifically, I just don't think they have a long-term franchise kind of cornerstone at that spot. So in this particular scenario, I kind of, instead of going with, you know, maybe the Cardinals trading back after they did that last year, or the Chargers being a popular one, I kind of played a different scenario. The Patriots are getting, you know, potentially two first-round picks, which they obviously need to continue to build and get high-end talent to infuse some youth at some premium positions. But also, just thinking about, like, they could still take a quarterback at the back end of round one, which I have them doing, or they could take one on day two or day three. So I think for the Patriots, like, I don't think it's because they're not sold on top quarterbacks, but I'm thinking in this particular scenario, you know, maybe they kind of favor Daniels and they feel comfortable knowing that Minnesota has multiple first round picks to offer and they can really plug a few different holes. So that was kind of my thinking in having the Patriots trade back to 11. They get an offensive tackle, which we can talk about in a bit, and then a quarterback later. But I also think for the Vikings, it's pretty obvious they want to move up and get a quarterback. So for me, instead of waiting for like a JJ McCarthy to kind of land in the spot that they want to, I felt like if they get to three and then they can kind of pick and choose between Daniels or May, and I feel like they will be fine with either guy. I don't know this for a fact, but I just have a feeling just based on what Kevin O'Connell's offense is based off of and what those guys do as passers and as runners, I feel like they would make sense in the Vikings offense. But yeah, that was kind of this, you know, kind of talking through the scenario. I just felt like where the Patriots are currently, where they have to be, they still have a ways to go. And even if they get the top quarterback, do they have the offensive line to support him? You know, do they have the sufficient weapons? There's still so many questions, I think, with the Patriots, even if you take a top quarterback. So in this particular scenario, I have them traded back.
And I guess from what you're saying there, you would think that if it was the situation that the Vikings, the Commanders took May, but the Vikings still made the trade, you think they would very likely take Daniels ahead of JJ McCarthy, despite the fact that they seem to be the team probably in the last, since the combine, really heavily linked with McCarthy. But you think if the two options were there, it would be Daniels ahead of McCarthy?
Yeah, I think so. I just think Daniels is little bit, I feel like you're getting, you know where you're getting a little bit more from Daniels versus McCarthy. Not that McCarthy can't get there. And obviously they have Sam Darnold as well. So I think it really just comes down to, you know, who is there at three, who's available. But I still feel like Daniels would be the pick over McCarthy, but I wouldn't fault them for taking McCarthy at three if they want to do that. But I feel like you don't have to trade up to three if you're going to do that. So to me, kind of, I guess my thinking is if you're trading up to three, you're trying to take one of the top three quarterbacks. You know, that would be kind of the thinking. Not necessarily that they wouldn't take McCarthy, but I just feel like if you're going up that high, you have to be pretty sure that you want that guy, you know, specifically. And I feel like Daniels and May fits that bill more so than McCarthy at three. But, you know, if they miss out on one of those three quarterbacks, obviously McCarthy would be at the top of the options for them. But that's kind of my thing. I think if they trade up to three, you're trying to get Daniels or May at that spot.
And then I suppose in terms of, you know, the Chargers, the Giants, you know, are the next group, maybe kind of the 5 to 9, let's say. Did anything that any of those teams did in, well, with the Falcons obviously getting Kirk Cousins, but like how much of an impact did free agency have on your thinking in relation to that group of teams?
I think it confirmed what they need. You know, I think the Giants feel like a team that should go and get a quarterback, but obviously, they still have Daniel Jones. They signed Drew Locke in free agency. So to me, it seems like at least that's the group that they're going to run with, right? So we know they put, you know, some resources into receiver last year. and have done so over the last couple of years, but they still are lacking kind of that top receiving option. And I feel like Rome Odunze fits that for them as they continue. And obviously they got Brian Burns in the trade. That edge rusher, you know, could have been a potential need for them as well. But they got Brian Burns and obviously Kayvon Thibodeau. So to me, it just kind of made things a little bit more clear for those teams 5 through 9. The Chargers, they lost Keenan Allen and Mike Williams. They have to get a receiver. I know offensive lineman was a big talking point for a couple of weeks there for the Chargers. Would they take Joe Alt if they stayed at 5? But with them losing their receivers, they need weapons around Justin Herbert. So that's the kind of the logic behind the Neighbors pick. And then for the Falcons, they've always needed a high-end pass rusher. You know, that's been something that coming into draft season that they needed, and coming out of free agency, I think, has still been a lingering need. So it makes sense. And then for the Bears, they need another guy opposite of Montez Sweat to be kind of that do-it-all, can rush the passer, run stopper, and continue to build at premium positions. Obviously, they took Darnell Wright last year. Then you get Caleb Williams in a premium edge rusher. Although I do think they could be in the market for maybe a corner or maybe in market for a guy like Byron Murphy. But just based on what they did in free agency, I think those teams, and obviously the Tennessee Titans letting go Andre Dillard, made a lot of sense in taking a tackle at 7. And getting Joe Alt as your franchise left tackle just makes a lot of sense for Tennessee. So 5 through 9, I feel like they all made it crystal clear in what they needed to go and upgrade. And to me, it made it a little bit more clear doing this mock draft as opposed to the last two.
Then you spent a bit of time with the Titans pick, and it didn't overlap with Sean Payton's time in New Orleans. But I'm wondering what your thoughts are, because this is a guy, Sean Payton's turning 60. He comes to the Broncos. He's a Super Bowl winning head coach, but Super Bowl winning head coaches in their second teams haven't tended to do all that well. He's obviously synonymous with Drew Brees and what they achieved in New Orleans. He now finds himself in a situation with the Broncos where they're kind of in a little bit in no man's land. They're at 12 currently. They've got all this dead cap from Russ. It's not like the roster is super stacked. You have the Broncos going up to take JJ McCarthy. Can he, from, you know, your study of college football and what McCarthy has done, is he good enough to be? Because there's a lot of pressure on Sean Payton to get this right for his legacy. Can JJ McCarthy be that guy, Devin?
I think in time he can be. And, you know, obviously, I heard a stat today that Sean Payton has never taken a quarterback in the first two rounds as a head coach. So this would certainly be a change, but I mean, they absolutely have to get a quarterback of the future. They didn't go out and sign anyone in free agency thus far at quarterback. They just have Jarrett Stidham on the roster. So for Sean Payton, you know, to hang his hat on JJ McCarthy and his development, it's going to be tough, but I think he has the mental makeup and kind of teaching and developing, I think, is going to be obviously the challenge. But, you know, a lot of people point to what Drew Brees was able to do with Sean Payton over the years and the Saints. And, you know, I think there are, I don't want to say similarities, but you can see some resemblances of what J.J. McCarthy does and how he can operate in offense and keep them in third at manageables and use his running skill set to move first downs. So I think they're in a position where I think he probably has at least 2 years, Sean Payton does, to kind of turn things around and right the ship. But I feel like they can't leave the draft without having some sort of developmental or, you know, quarterback, high-end quarterback that they can build around. And I think with picking JJ McCarthy and what he can do for Denver, I just think his skill set lends itself to what Sean Payton likes to do, being accurate in the quick game, being able to make plays outside of the pocket and keep the chains moving. I think he checks all those boxes in what Sean Payton might be looking for in a quarterback. Obviously, the leadership qualities that McCarthy brings and has been lauded throughout the draft process as well, and knows how to win games and not always win them pretty. And I think that's kind of an underrated aspect, you know, in talking about quarterbacks, is that you just not only do you know how to win, you know, games, but close them as well. And J.J. McCarthy obviously has done a pretty good job at doing that at his time in Michigan. I think that'll translate well to Denver. But Denver has to get a quarterback, whether it's in the first round, whether they trade up to get one in the second round. It has to be done this year. They need something to look towards the future because you can't keep having these bridge starters. But I think in general, just to answer your question, I think McCarthy would give the Broncos a chance to be good, maybe not next year, but the year after is what I'm looking at, is when they can continue to build pieces, build in a draft, you know, acquire some more talent, especially at the receiver position, because they've really started to build up that offensive line and trying to really improve that. So I think Denver in general, they're in a spot where they need difference makers, but they also need to figure out the quarterback position for the long term.
And the look, we're a year out and a lot can change, but would the consensus seems to be that next year's QB class is not a vintage crop. Would that be your take on it as well? I mean, in terms of if the Broncos and Sean Payton and others were to write off this season, all the talk seems to be like you're really rolling the dice next year, and potentially even QB5 this year would potentially be QB1 next year. Would that be your read on it, Devin?
I think it's early to tell for sure, but I would say the group at the top, at the very least, is smaller than it was this time last year. You know, obviously we knew about Drake May and Caleb Williams in the spring of last year, but I think there's no big consensus right now in terms of who's at the top of the quarterback class. You know, obviously there's names like Carson Beck and Shedeur Sanders, to this two names that consistently kind of float around, but there's no definitive top guy. So I think that's going to make a fascinating, obviously, summer into the fall session. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just based on, you know, what we've seen and what we've gone through this draft process, you know, there's a potential, you know, like a Michael Penix or Michael Pratt, you know, or Bo Nix, you know, ends up on day two and ends up being a starter down the road. So, you know, I just think, obviously, we got to take the quarterback classes case by case. But I think at least right now, you know, there's not a lot of confidence that the guys that are in the mix for QB1 next year end up turning out to be those guys. So I think there's definitely some hesitation just around the league and just in general consensus and how good those guys are going to translate. And certainly, like the Carson Becks of the world, Shedeur Sanders, like I mentioned, you know, there's some wild cards in Jalen Milroe, Cam Ward. There's so many like interesting names out there right now for the next year's class, but I don't think anyone's separated themselves from the pack. So I would say if you're kicking the can down the road for next year's quarterback class, you know, you're kind of betting that one of those guys will emerge. And if they do, I mean, you might not even be in position to take them. So I think if you have the opportunity to take a quarterback in this class, you should do it just because the uncertainty around next year's class and you don't know who's going to rise, who's going to fall. You can't hope that one of those guys, you know, and you can't put your money on one of those guys, you know, ending up being, you know, a franchise cornerstone this time next year.
I suppose after we get to outside the top 10, then who are some of the guys that, you know, you're kind of really intrigued or hyped or whatever it is to see them? That can be kind of that you're certain that are as certain as one can be that like this should really transition well into the pro game, or somebody who you think I'm not sure if it's going to work. If it does, the ceiling's really high, but in the rest of the first round, that from your mock, who are some of the guys that you're really interested to see how it plays out when they do get drafted and they do enter the league?
Yeah, I think the first one that comes to mind is Tyler Guyton, the offensive tackle from Oklahoma. And he'll be able to hit his ceiling. So for me, Tyler Guyton is kind of the guy that I have some of the biggest question marks in terms of, is he going to pan out and be the high-end possible all-pro level type of tackle? Or is he going to be a guy that kind of just ends up bouncing around because he could never really fully develop? And to me, there's only a few spots that come to mind, at least in the first round, that I feel confident that he'll go to and actually succeed and develop. And to me, it's like Philly and San Francisco. And I haven't gone to San Francisco in this mock, but I feel like he's going to reach his max potential, especially in such a deep tackle class. I feel like Guyton is kind of the wild card, you know, towards the end of the first round, early second round. Like, are you going to take the swing on him? You know, is he a guy that you feel comfortable with taking in that range? And do you feel like he can reach his full potential as a cornerstone right tackle? Maybe a team wants him to move to left tackle at some point. So to me, he's kind of the guy that, like, I'm pinning. And then, you know, obviously another guy at the tackle class that not necessarily I'm worried about his projection to the NFL, but more so where he goes, is Amarius Mims from Georgia. You know, some people have him going late first round. Some people have him going like in the teens and early 20s. And I have him going 13 to the Raiders in this particular mock. But I feel like the NFL in general was higher on him than we even think, just based on what he did in his workouts at the combine, how he moves. He only started 8 games, you know, over the last couple seasons for Georgia, but those starts were high level. You know, he did some really nice things in those games when he did start. So it's like you're kind of battling like the inexperience versus like what he can be and the skill set that he brings. And I think teams are going to be so enamored with it that they're going to do that. So he's a guy that I'm interested in seeing where he lands. And then Jerzon Noon from Illinois. I love his film. I think he's the top interior defensive lineman in this class. I have him going 35 to the Cardinals. Honestly, I thought about putting him at 27 for the Cardinals instead, but I know the Cardinals needed some defensive back help. But Noon to me is a guy that everyone thought was going to be a top 10, top 15 pick coming in the season. His film suggests that he should be. But obviously, him being undersized, one, although Byron Murphy isn't much bigger than him in terms of stature, but two, his unavailability throughout the draft process because he had an injury, you know, kind of late in the season that carried over into the draft process. He hasn't been able to test. Not sure if he's going to test during this process, and maybe if he does, it'll be later in April. So to me, he's a guy that, you know, right now he's kind of on the downturn. A lot of people put him late first, early second. But if he comes back, tests well, continues to show that he's an athlete and that he's healthy, I could see him kind of rocketing back up in the mocks. And maybe he's a mid to late first round pick instead of being a potential day two pick. So those are a couple of names for me that kind of stood out doing this mock, like where to slot them, where they should go. And where they could end up being. But the offensive line class in general, you know, I think I have 8 or 9 offensive linemen coming off the board in the first round. So it's definitely deep. It's definitely robust. And if you need one, this is a good class to take one.
No, thanks. Some really, kind of really interesting insights there. Mims, I think, is a fascinating one to me because, as you said, like he's so he tests in such a way, and we've seen the league kind of fall in love, say, with a different player, a different position, but with Jordan Davis in that kind of like, so kind of off the charts in terms of how they test, but it hasn't worked out so well. But it's the NFL. Teams never learn, and they always think it's going to be for us. The Raiders are a team I could definitely see rolling the dice, how it will go there under the now full-time head coach will be interesting to see. Just maybe one more question on the draft. I do want to dip into the Eagles a little bit, but you have your, I think the first RB that I saw come off the board in your latest mock, it was at 56 for the Cowboys. Is that a comment on this particular class, or do you think that the league is just not valuing the position in the same way, Devin?
Yeah, I think it's just this particular draft because, like, you saw so many running backs get deals early in free agency, so much movement around the NFL with running backs. And I just really think it was indictment of the running back class this year and it not being strong or not full, being full of, future starters in the NFL, more of complementary pieces, more of like change of pace types of guys. So for me, I think it really just came down to kind of the lack of the talent at the top of the class in terms of being potential starters, being, future starters in the NFL and the NFL just feeling like they should just get veterans and have veteran guys and sign them in free agency. So I think that's kind of what played a part in the first running back not coming off too late in the second round and Jonathan Brooks coming off the board. So I just really think it was more so because of the lack of starters in this class that they ended up being the way that it was in my particular mock. I think a lot more, I think three or four guys probably come off the board in round three and potentially round four, you start to see a good run on running backs. But I think in this class, I wouldn't be surprised if we went through two rounds and not a single running back came off the board.
It's always interesting to see, I suppose, which positions, are kind of considered stacked and where there might be somewhere there's a little bit of a drought. Now, I want to touch on the Eagles before I let you go, and you've been generous with your time. But I suppose I'm intrigued because things fell off a cliff at the end of last season. And when Drew Lock beat you on the last drive, that tells you where you're at. Once I saw that, I knew they weren't winning a playoff game, and then true to form, that's what happened. What is it that, or do you get a sense, what is it that Nick Sirianni did that convinced them to bring him back? Because everything that he did, I went to the Super Bowl the previous season, but everything, he was like King Midas in reverse. It was the antithesis of King Midas after, say, week six or seven last year. The change in DC, did that come from above him? Is that one of the reasons they were willing to kind of bring him back? But he just never seemed to have an answer. And going into that playoff game against the Bucks, everybody knew what the Bucks were going to do. And yet, he never made life easier for Jalen Hurts. It's like the Patrick Mahomes is one of the best quarterbacks we've ever seen, has the potential to become the GOAT. And yet, Andy Reid always ensures that there's an escape valve for Patrick Mahomes. The Eagles did nothing like that for Jalen Hurts, so everybody knew what to expect. So I'm just wondering, with all of what fell apart, the changes, obviously, the backroom, Big Dom, all of that stuff. What is it that the Eagles, that convinced the Eagles to bring Sirianni back? Because he's still on a pretty hot seat, you have to imagine.
Yeah, his seat didn't get any cooler just based on what happened. But I think it just really came down to, I think, the fact that his resume, I mean, he took them to the playoffs his first 3 years as a coach for the Eagles. Despite, what has happened, the kind of late season miscues, I mean, everything that they did, in terms of like changing the defensive coordinators, changing the lineups, on defense, changing the secondary, Darius Slay being out to get some, clean up his knee. I mean, everything that they did that, just didn't work out. And I think that kind of played a part in why he stayed is that, they weren't stagnant in terms of what they did. Was it smart to change the defensive coordinators in the middle of the season? Probably not, especially looking in hindsight. But I think because he was willing to make changes that may not have been ultra popular maybe in the locker room, and whether that came from him or came from up above, I think kind of remains the question. certainly him going out and hiring two established coordinators, I think, came from up above. So I think we're in a scenario where, you know, he was willing to do whatever he needed to do to keep his job. And even if that meant like losing some of his, you know, close friends that he brought on to work, and some good relationships that he had with some of the previous coaching staff, and letting them go and keeping them, you know, or letting them go and moving on and bringing in more established names that brought in some of their own coaches, I think signals that he's willing to change what he did last year. You know, coming into the season, there was a quote that basically they weren't going to do anything. I won't say do anything differently, but more so they weren't going to like drastically change their offensive approach. And obviously that didn't work out because they didn't have answers for blitzes. You know, their offense was still RPO based, and you know, they would get a drive going, a lot of inconsistencies drive to drive. So I really think it just what made him stay is his willingness to change how they approach how they play offensively and defensively. Well, not necessarily defensively because they're still in a Vic Fangio scheme, but their willingness to bring in a different voice, so they're not just running his offense per se, but they're melding multiple offenses and trying to figure out the best way to maximize Jalen Hurts. So I think that kind of played the part of him staying. They didn't want to make another huge coaching change, although they just did that, you know, after doing that with Doug Peterson about 4 or 5 years ago. And I think they just wanted to have some stability. And, you know, Sirianni is still well-liked in the locker room, even though, you know, he got into some arguments with some players on the sideline and things just kind of spiraled out of control that last month and a half of the season. He's still well-liked in the locker room. You know, players love, you know, his ability to motivate them and you know, pump them up and bring that energy that the team needs. So I think that all plays a part in him staying versus moving on. And you know, obviously there was a good coaching pool, coaching candidate pool this offseason. But I think, you know, the Eagles felt comfortable that they were going to make big changes in their coordinators, position coaches, and try something different to best maximize and getting some, you know, well-renowned coaches and Kellen Moore and Vic Fangio to come on as coordinators, I think, played a huge part.
Yeah, no, thanks for, I suppose, giving some insight into that. I'm wondering, in terms of the expectations, I've been fortunate when I've told this story. People who listen and watch the show will have heard me talk about when I was 17, spending some time in Philly for months and kind of getting a little bit of a sense of it. And I love the passion of Philly fans, but you're going into a season where Sirianni remains on the hot seat. You've lost Jason Kelce. You've lost Fletcher Cox, so two enormous kind of voices and leaders on the field. We know that Vic Fangio's defensive scheme tends to take a lot of time to learn. Are they going to allow a long enough lead for the Eagles to kind of find their feet next year? Because losing Kelce is such a huge piece, you know. And, you know, you've got Kellen Moore. The offense is going to look a little bit different. Is there going to be enough patience in that front office, do you think, if things maybe don't get off to a little bit of a rocky start? If they're sitting at, say, 2-4, is that it for Sirianni? Do you get that sense?
I think they will at least give him, you know, half the season, I would think, you know, to kind of make that decision. Honestly, I feel like the Eagles are the type of organization to let it play out and just let them, you know, let them go for the rest of the season. But certainly the writing will be on the wall if they get off to a poor start and, you know, there's more changes happening, you know, whether it's Sirianni, like, you know, giving up some duties or, you know, if you start to see some internal changes or some operational changes, I think that kind of signals that, you know, he's probably gone. And then also when you think about the coordinator hires, they're kind of built in to be, quote unquote, the interim coach. You know, if they do decide to move on from him. You know, obviously Vic Fangio having the head coaching experience that he has, and then Kellen Moore obviously looking for potential head coaching opportunities too. You know, I think it's kind of built in that if they do decide to move on, they have the voices in the building already to just assume that position, you know, with Fangio obviously having done that already in his coaching career. So I think there is certainly some built in, you know, second and third options if things go south, you know, and you know, Sirianni just isn't doing the job that they expect him to do. So I wouldn't be surprised if, like, you know, they, like you said, they start like 2-4 and maybe start to hear some rumblings that, you know, his seat is extremely hot and, you know, they're basically wanting to see improvement in play. But I don't think he has a lot of leash anymore. Obviously, after making it to the Super Bowl, the leash was extremely long. And even like halfway into the season, I mean, they were in a good spot. They were 11-1 at one point. So I think it certainly got smaller, you know, after the rough finish. And obviously, you know, they took a long time and thought long and hard about whether or not to keep him. But I think if they got off to a slow start, the pressure is only going to surmount. But if they, you know, turn out to be a dud this year, he's definitely gone.
Yeah, certainly will be interesting to see. Devin, I want to thank you for taking the time to chat to me today. For people on this side of the Atlantic who want to check out more of your stuff, and it's absolutely worthwhile all the time, but obviously particularly with the draft, just about, what, five, 6 weeks away at this point, where can they check out more of your stuff?
Yeah, so on X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it, you can follow me at RealD_Jackson. And then all my work is on the Philadelphia Inquirer website, inquirer.com. I'm in my social media or my Twitter profile. My author page is in there as well if you want to check out my draft work.
Absolutely, and would encourage anyone watching or listening to do just that. Well, the draft will be here in a blink of an eye, and we have, as we are recording this, there are a number of Irish guys taking part in a pro day down at the University of South Florida, kickers and punters. So it'll be interesting to see if any of those, they won't be in the draft, but if any of those can find their way on to a roster over the coming months. Devin, thanks again for taking the time to chat to me today. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, enjoyed it as well. Thanks for having me on, and looking forward to talking down the road at some point again.
Thank you for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please do vote with your fingers and rate, review, or subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. Every click, every like, every positive review, and every additional subscriber makes a huge difference. It helps others to find the show, and we really do appreciate it. We'd also love to hear from you and to interact with NFL fans on our social channels, wherever you're listening in the world, so please do get in touch.